session number 9998, reel 3.
Peter Mercell, Reel 3. What were your duties when you became director of training?
My duties, I'm sure, were simply to keep the training schools working efficiently and to see that there were enough men and women available to be trained on to become pilots. The schools themselves were autonomous and they had their own COs, and the CO was responsible to me. If he had problems, the first person he'd come to would be me, and I'd have to see what the problems were and try and sort them out. But much of the time, apart from visiting the schools and sort of getting the feel of them and seeing what was going on, was spent, for instance, at the Ministry of Aircraft Production, if there were any supply problems for aircraft, policy in selection of pilots, discussing with people like the CEO of ATA and Philip Wills what the requirements were for the future, and then using the establishment officers to get hold of people when we, by various means, found them. I don't remember how we did select people. I think we let it be known that we wanted, as I said, mostly women, and we'd then go through a selection process and see that they fitted in. But my real job was to make sure that the schools were fulfilling the needs of providing pilots of different standards all the way through.
What was your success rate with the ab initio pilots?
I don't remember that accurately. We did find quite a number couldn't make it, but I, at a guess, I would have said the success rate was 60 to 70%, something like that. But that's rather a guess. I have no statistics on that.
Did you ever have to make alterations to the basic conversion program?
No, I think by the time I'd got there, most of it was settled. As I remember it, we then did go on to flying boats. I don't think we were doing flying boats when I took over. And I think jets came along towards the end. But the main pattern was established. And there was an ab initio school, and then the light aircraft school, and then the advanced school. And, of course, you had to teach them navigation as well at that point, so that there was quite a lot of flying done to make sure that somebody could get from A to B. But once they could do one area properly, they would ferry aircraft on that route until they got a little more experienced, and they move up bit by bit. Quite a lot of the training was done, in other words, in the pools.
Did you yourself progress to flying boats and jets?
Jets, yes. I mean, really, there was jets were, if anything, easier to fly. I did a number of flights in flying boats and took off and landed, I think, once or twice, but not as chief pilot, merely to see what was involved so that I could make sensible decisions as director of training. The jets, I did flew a few Meteors, I think, and they were really very easy because there were less problems, I thought, in flying those than the propeller aeroplanes. At the end, the propeller aeroplanes had such powerful engines that the aeroplanes wanted to fly around the propellers instead of the propellers around the aeroplanes, and that torque was quite a major problem. But with jets, you didn't have that, so that they were most exciting to fly, but not because they were difficult.
What was your own routine?
Well, I had much too much office work for my pure pleasure at that time, with all the schools and so on. But I'd get to flying as much as I could. But it wasn't nearly as much as when I was at Radcliffe. So in that sense, it was rather sad. I used to get a few flights over to the continent at the end. I don't remember actually delivering any aircraft, fighters and things. At the key point, I was always hooked up at home, with the schools, but I did fly around Europe a bit. I think I did some delivering of aircraft to Germany and I believe Czechoslovakia at one point. But that was real fun, but I couldn't be away so long, as long as I'd like to have been, to fly more.
Why was ATA going into Europe?
Oh, to deliver aircraft to the squadrons as they went further away from, further into Europe. And of course you had to fetch the pilots back. There was a lot of controversy about whether they would be allowed to, and I don't think some of the senior RAF people were very keen on it at the beginning, but when they got desperate and found they could only get them there by using ATA, then they did, and they found ATA did the job perfectly well. In fact, I think on the whole more reliably than the RAF, because the RAF pilots were brought up to take risks and attack all the time, whereas ferry pilots were there to get it safely from A to B.
How closely to the front line did you fly?
Oh, I don't think I went anywhere near the front line. Yes, I did, Belgium, and I'd forgotten. Yes, I flew Typhoons and up to both Belgium and Holland. And yes, we were pretty near the front line then. But, you know, you deliver an aircraft into the squadron, taken straight over, you had to spend the night with the squadron. Somehow get home again, I forget how, collected by some aircraft, I expect. But I didn't do a lot of it. And if I did, I had to ask the pool commander if they'd let me have an airplane.
Was there any shortage of pilots going into Europe? Were people keen to go?
Oh, no, flat out to go. A great competition, no doubt of that.
Were there any dangers at that point?
I don't think so, no.
What about navigating across the channel?
Well, it's so short. I mean, the speed you were doing then, it was only sort of 10 minutes, something like that, and you could probably see the other side very often before you started. I don't think there were any navigation problems. The navigation problems were greater if you were going down to Normandy, because you had a much longer sea crossing, as the one I had at the very beginning of the war. But there, you just trusted to your compass and flew. But I don't think there were really any navigation problems, so long as there wasn't a complete overcast close down to the ground.
What was your impression of Europe as you arrived?
Oh, pretty devastated, particularly when you got to Germany. Then they did look absolutely awful. All the pictures that one saw of devastated cities were, well, just to see them in fact made them much more real and awful. I mean, Cologne and Frankfurt and places like that were absolutely appalling. I wondered how ever they'd start again, but they did. And how life went on. I mean, when you went, drove through the towns, you wondered where everybody lived, because there was just nothing standing. But they were living in cellars, I think, mostly.
What sort of a reception did you get when you arrived as an ATA pilot?
I don't remember anything being difficult. I remember you were simply somebody who'd brought in you were a sort of bus driver delivering the goods, and off you went to go. Everybody was very friendly. We were accepted by the RAF all the way through, in a very nice way indeed. They accepted these strange people most happily. I think there were lots of stories about ladies arriving in aeroplanes, which the COs had said, well, these are very dangerous aeroplanes. Out stepped a rather petite young lady, and that rather caused some comments, but no, they were very good, and we were accepted in all the messes. Somebody had said early on that we were to be accepted in the messes, and it worked very well. Even the squadrons, the bomber squadrons, I remember when they were bombing a lot, occasionally one got stuck at the bomber station overnight, and they'd allow you to go and watch the watch office to see what was happening. They went off and then came back again. It made it all very real and made one realise what an easy job we had compared to the pilots going off bombing and with the fighters.
As the war moved to an end, how soon did you start to wind down the training programme?
I don't strictly remember. I know we slowed up, but then there were fewer pilots wanted, and therefore we were slowing up, because we reached a plateau towards the end of the war. and everybody felt that the only thing that might cause it to continue would be a war in Japan, and they want aircraft, and we should still have jobs flying them to and from the factories and maintenance unit. But I don't remember how we wound it down. I know a number of pilots asked to go when the pressure was off, and possibly after D-Day. But I do remember the whole thing winding down because there was no pressure to fly. There was a shortage of aircraft to fly about, and people began to go off. But I don't remember the exact sort of mechanics of winding it down.
What happened to you as the war ended?
Well, I soon found that my job really didn't exist anymore as director of training. There was nothing to, and no recruitment to be done. And so I said, well, do you want me? And the answer was, no, not really. So I said, thanks very much. And I came back here to grow fruit. And beyond being offered a job by Delanger, which I inquired about, I said, no, I think I'd rather stay a fruit grower. Very glad I did. I did very little flying after the war. Three of us took an interest in the flying club at White Waltham. In fact, we owned it, three of us, for a bit. But it was a bit of a bore. It wasn't very profitable, and so we sold out in the end. But that's most of the flying I did. I went flying occasionally with Charles Gardner again, because he kept on his flying. But other than that, going flying with him in his helicopter and that kind of thing, I haven't done anything for a good many years.
How did you feel about giving up flying?
Well, sad in many ways, but it wasn't the same kind of flying as we'd had before the war or during the war. You had lots of restrictions. You couldn't fly where you wanted, flight plans and getting permission to do this, that and the other. And therefore, a lot of the fun of it was gone. So I didn't. There were plenty of other things to do. A lot of sailing and so on, so I don't think I'd really missed it.